This insert is brought to you by Radio K Pulpit on 7 to 9 AM. Visit us on www.kpulpit.co.za.
This is Corrie Davidson's second week with us. Be sure to catch up on the podcast if you've missed last week's session. Corrie is a clinical social worker for the past 30 years or so. She specializes in addiction, codependency, trauma, and relationship counseling. She still journeys with those struggling with addictions, hurts, hang-ups, and habits they struggle to shake off. And she also works with partners of addicts and sees them as a couple as well.
Yeah, thank you very much. We're very, very welcome again, Corrie. And
thank you.
Yeah, last week we started speaking about the fact that just a year ago, our national lockdown, over a year ago, started in South Africa. And we mentioned how that affected our emotional well-being and even sometimes our physical well-being, our economic well-being, and how that affected our partners, our spouses, and the wider families around us, our children and our parents and so forth. So what have you seen in your practice? What are some of the trends that you've noticed during this time of the pandemic?
Especially with families.
Yeah, with regards to families, yeah.
Yeah, I think families really took strain and parents took strain. They were often at home working from home or maybe having lost their jobs.
Mm.
And the kids are also at home. They were not at school.
Mm.
So suddenly there's a tremendous amount of pressure on the parents in terms of the structure of the day, in terms of childcare. And of course, the worries about schooling and mostly parents had to do the double role of both being working and doing schooling at home. I think it was especially a stressful time for families.
And on top if I may just mention something now, on top of that, as you were talking about that, the grief and the stress of people getting ill, especially in the second wave, when we often heard about families that, or maybe friends that passed away, and the fear that I experienced from children asking their parents and maybe family members that passed away. So that was an added emotional burden and struggle for families to know how to go about it. Maybe even a mom that immediate family members that passed away.
Yes, okay. I think you're right. I think the second wave, we don't know what's ahead for us, but the second wave definitely brought it much more closer for families when you more often heard about family members who died, a grandmother, or people really, or even people, children getting COVID. So it suddenly came closer and closer. And I think it's so important for families to talk about the emotions and the uncertainty that we all live in. We don't always need to have all the answers, but to at least acknowledge the uncertain times.
Mm.
And also the faith in that, but we know that this too shall pass.
Mm.
We know that we have faced many things as a family maybe, or as a human race, and we need to then model something of that hope and the knowledge of that things will turn again.
Mm.
I think that's one of the important things that parents can do at this stage, because children are incredibly resilient, but they need to know it is safe. They need to know it's even in the unknown that we will be okay.
I totally relate to what you were saying, that the second wave brought the COVID-19 pandemic much closer to us. And often it was said by people that numbers have now become names. And so that you can start naming people Yaku or David or whatever, Philip, my friend, my good friend that was in ministry, whatever. So it become names, and I think very often we don't take the time to grieve, and it's not only the grieving of the losses of a loved one, but some people have lost jobs. Some people have lost half of their income. Some people have lost the freedom that they have had before to move around. So we need to grieve.
And plans, things that they look forward to that they couldn't do anymore. Hey?
Mm.
And, you know, I'm just thinking of kiddies that just started school or university students that had to go to their first year who have lost that experience or, let's say, the normality and now have to go back and experience. I found that with some kids there were quite high anxiety and at some stage that they were really getting so comfortable at home that they didn't. They fear moving out again. And so, yes, we as parents have to really guide into these unknown places and help form the bridges for them to be able to go. I remember with one family, I recommended that before the child went back to school, that the parents just took him there to see, this is the rugby field, this is where my classroom is, yes, everything is still here, just to alleviate some of the anticipatory anxiety.
We're talking about different stages of the pandemic, hey, and certain times of grief and then times of going back, because it's an ongoing time. It's a year already. So in this time, we've all gone through many different phases of the pandemic.
Is for me a similarity maybe that we can also just mention here, and that is the importance of talking. In our families, often we don't talk about stuff that's uncomfortable, and it may include things like addiction. We think the children are too young. We don't want to burden them. Whilst many times the children have actually heard things, or they've picked up on an energy. They don't know exactly what it is, but they know there's a problem. And that is actually what causes anxiety. It's better if the child gets the opportunity to talk about the unknown. Or if we can clarify, yes, you've probably seen mommy sleeping more often. She's feeling very lethargic. She's really finding she doesn't have energy. Then the child knows, okay, so this is what's happening. Very important that we just get words to help and to acknowledge to the children this is not normal times or this is not what we are used to.
Yes, or, talk about the elephant in the room, because that's sometimes what we don't do.
I think very important what you are saying, Corey, is also that it's age-related. In other words, you want to share in the same way with your preschooler or pre-primary child and then what you would share with your university-going child. But I think the very, very important thing is to talk and to talk in such a way that it builds the relationship and not break it down, and it brings less anxiety and stress and not bring more anxiety and stress.
And to acknowledge their fears. I think so many parents want to protect, and then when a child has got a fear, they say, no, that's nothing. You shouldn't worry about
that. Don't feel that.
Instead of acknowledging and normalizing a lot of the struggles that, kids would go through. Are there other things that you find that families can do to help resiliency, to build that in their families?
You know, like with a coupleship, I find that if the family has a little project that they do and they all become part of it to a greater or lesser degree, whether it is that we are going to build a treehouse during this pandemic, or we're going to do this little task, but we're all going to have benefits because of that. It must be something that everybody is getting excited about. That's very important, because that's also investing in the future that's still coming. Again, the hope that there is life out there. We're going to get there. Very important. I was just thinking of this age-appropriate thing, to also allow the kids to ask questions once given them some basic information. So that one can hear where they are at. You know, there's that joke, and I'll just quickly tell it, that where the boy says, "Mom, where do I come from?" Mom then saw, "Oh my gosh, here we are, the bees and the flowers," and she tells the whole story, and the little boy bursts out crying, and she says, "Why are you crying?" And he said, "Because my friend is coming from Joburg.
Exactly.
And so we can miss really what is really what the child is asking.
I like what you're saying with regards to the project, Corey. You know, project together as a family. You know, many families may not even have the space to build something like a tree house, or maybe not even a tree in the yard. But it doesn't have to be a complicated project that they are doing together. Suka and I have received some a project to do that's going to be very good for us, and that is to make a collage of our relationship. And so also the family can, you know, take all the old magazines that are lying around in the house and build a collage of what they would, what is on their heart, and so forth, and make something very creative from something very simple.
And I'm also thinking, I know when our kids were still young, we had these wonderful reading times, you know, that we would do a certain book at a certain time that everybody enjoyed. And we often did that on the way on holidays. But of course, this is not appropriate now because pandemics, they wouldn't be able to travel. But lately, people can travel. So we had this thing that we were always doing, stories that everybody enjoyed listening to. So there are so many things a person can do as points of connection.
It's back to basics, hey, and back to anything that is connecting and is age-appropriate connecting.
Okay, it's time to take a short break. We're going to be back after the music.
Yeah, thank you for being with us again, Corey. And, you know, we were talking about families before the break and how the pandemic has influenced families. And then some of the families, the parents are actually involved in some, one of the parents in addictions and the other with other issues and hang-ups. So I've often heard it saying that the best gift parents can give to their children is to show and demonstrate that they love each other, that they are committed to each other, and that they are going to stay together. Because I think one of the greatest fears children have is that their parents will separate or divorce, and that they have actually caused it. What are some of your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's so interesting how children, because their worldview is so limited, the initial thing is that I have done something wrong, or if I would make it easier, it wouldn't have happened. And, of course, the child that acts out and become the black sheep of the family is really saying, look, I'm the problem. I'm the problem. You guys are not the problem. Look how bad I am. And they really take the attention away from the primary problem that may be in the family, say, for instance, with addiction. So, I want to add to what you say, Frederick, that the best gift we can give our children is our own recovery, and that is for the addict and for the partner, because unfortunately life is not always as we want it, and we get the situation where maybe the addict is not ready for recovery, or it's so far down the lane, and then the so-called healthy parent, the healthy partner, is the one that really needs to demonstrate and show the manifest word, all the positive things, and that's quite a burden. But if that parent at least can be the healthy parent and show recovery behavior, that is something that the children will take with them throughout their whole life. Each partner needs to do their individual recovery so that they can get to the joint recovery.
Corey, at this program we often talk about addicts and then partners of addicts, and unfortunately, we found often in our own journey of recovery that it's often the addict that thinks that there's a problem with them, and then the partner would tell the addict to go and get help. But the partner would not realize that that person also needs help. Unfortunately, there have been often been unhealthy patterns that are developed in the relationship And like we always say, it takes two to tango. And so two actually participate in this healthy dance of the relationship, or the maybe not so healthy dance of the relationship. So how do you want to respond to this?
Yeah, you know, I think it's especially for the partner, and it can be the man or the woman, who are married to the addict, very difficult to make that adjustment to look at self, because we call it the IP, the identified patient, is so clearly the person with a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And often the partner feels, I have done so much already. What else do you want from me? I barely keep my head above water. So it's difficult in that moment then to realize that I have to come to my own assistance.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if my partner is still in active addiction. That I can't build more and more resentment. I need to come to my own assistance. And, of course, that's where the 12-step program comes in, both for the addict and the non-addict.
Mm. And it's interesting because I think many people are well known with the 12 steps for addicts and don't always realize that there are several step groups or groups that are also for partners of addicts, like Al-Anon, friends and family of those who struggle with alcohol, S-Anon, Narcotics Anonymous, what is it, like friends? I don't know what you know.
Of drugs, of drug addicts,
right.
And COSA for co-addicts of sex addiction, and so forth.
And if I could just say something there, it's also in our relationship we often share, because we shared our story in the beginning, and many people know about that, that I think a lot of the best work, the best growth in our relationship came when I realized that I also had a role to play. And I remember, just like you said, I was very frustrated in 2016, because our recovery actually started in 2010 already, but with lots of therapists and going to groups and everything. Didn't know about the 12 steps, really, didn't really know about that. And 2016, I really felt on my heart that I had to go to a 12-step program. And I felt so upset about it, because I tried to get away from it, but this feeling just didn't want to go away. And it was such an important part of my recovery, because it's only then when I really started looking at my part in the relationship. And a lot of the big breakthroughs we had in our relationship was after I started, and I started looking at myself and stopped looking at my poor addict husband, or he used to be an addict, it was a recovery addict, but anyway. So, Frederick, I don't know if you want to respond to that.
Yeah, I think this is something that we can speak about quite a bit. And there's a term that is used amongst counselors and so forth. It's called codependency.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was an issue. So some people may not understand codependency is when you want to fix or help or care for or rescue your partner. Jumping in somewhere where actually is not your responsibility. And we were actually co-dependents. Both of Suki and I were co-dependents and trying to rescue each other. And we were not really working at our own recovery and looking at ourselves and how to recover and to restore what has been stolen by our character defects and our old patterns coming from our families of origin.
What is so good about the 12 steps is that it is for everybody. Anybody can make use of it. All you need to do is the willingness to investigate that and the willingness to look for that help. And it's free of charge. People usually make a little donation. They have an opportunity if they would want to make a donation at the meetings. But we really need this as a huge resource. And for the partner to, and for the addict for that matter, to just sit in a room and suddenly they meet their tribe. They meet people that speak their language, that understand what they've been going through, and that have hope for recovery, irrespective of what's happening to my addicted partner. that is a huge new way of shifting, because by the time people reach out to the 12-step program, they have usually tried a lot of stuff, and it didn't work. It didn't work, and it made them hopeless and helpless and full of despair, because they're trying harder and harder and nothing is changing. And then to meet a program and meet other fellow travelers who are with them on the road, and that say, listen, start with yourself, because when you change, there will be a ripple effect. But you don't change, you change for that empowering and for the healing for yourself, because there's so much trauma that came with addiction.
And that's exactly where the safe space is. Because each of the people in that support group, no matter what fellowship or what type of support group it is, they accept. They do not judge. They love unconditionally. It doesn't matter what story you say, they are not shocked, because many of them have already gone through the same things and done the same crazy, insane things. And all they do is they say, we know, we've been there. And it becomes a very, very safe space. And what I also heard you saying, Corrie, is how both the addict and the partner of the addict need to take care of themselves. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, self-nurture and self-care? Because I know that was one of my greatest struggles, to take care of myself and nurture myself as the addict.
Yeah, the partner usually feel, I can't let go of my addicted partner, because then he or she will go down and it will be the end of the relationship. But the reality is that by holding on, we are drowning together. And so there is this healthy detachment that needs to happen, not loving, but detaching from the problem. Detaching from the alcoholism or the eating disorder or the gambling that is controlling my life and my family's life. And those are the concepts that one needs to work with, and that's when the self-care comes in. What does it mean to care for myself in this and not be preoccupied and controlled by the disease the other person may have and may be active in? Of course, once the partner starts getting, the addictive partner starts getting some to grips with some of the recovery concepts, there is quite a release that can happen, and it both can work together. Then that's when we start walking together. But initially, we need to each do our own recovery work, because that will take us to the next step.
Yes. And then also, just to get back to the self-care again, it's like detaching from the situation, attaching to oneself, attuning to oneself, and see, what do I need apart from what is happening here, to so that I can sustain this journey, so that I can continue along this journey, so that I don't get too tired or too over-emotional, and like you said, then we continue to drown together. Yeah, that is so important.
For the partners, we say there's the three C's. You haven't caused this, you can't control it, and you can't cure it. And it sounds such an easy recipe, but it's a huge step to really, truly, truly know that you haven't caused it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it. Especially the last one. Maybe I can love my partner more, and then, there will be recovery, but it doesn't work like that.
Corrie, do you have some final words for us as we're getting to the car? We want to conclude this program. Just maybe encouragement.
Yes, I think the relationship with self, the relationship with others, the relationship with our God, these things are that rope with the three cords that's tied in together. And when we attend to each of these aspects, we can get a very strong rope, like the one that they use for the big tankers and ships, that can really hold that and anchor it so that we don't go adrift and land up on the rocks.
Absolutely. And then also, like you say, the connection with God, because I know in the steps there's a specific thing saying, I'm powerless. I cannot do this. only God can help me, and He can, and that's the beginning. And as we continue with those three ropes that you're talking about, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being with us, Corrie, and we look forward to maybe even speaking to you again in the future. So, listeners, maybe you tuned in a little bit late and you want to hear what was said in the podcast. You can listen on the podcast at kpulpit.co.za, and send your remarks, questions, comments to our email address, Frederick Soeke, FrederickSoeke, Fred Soeke at kpulpit.co.za.
Till next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Hierdie insetsel is aan jou gebring deur Radio Kaapse Kansel op 729 AM. Besoek ons gerus op www.kaapsekansel.co.za.